Blockhouse Conversations, bringing you thought-provoking discussions from the documentary world.
Hello, welcome to Blockhouse Conversations. My name is Carol Nara. My guest today is Katrina Cizek, a Canadian director and a pioneer in digital documentaries. She's one of the most interesting and inspiring creators working today in the digital space. We will be talking about two projects close to Kat's heart: Wintopia, a new film about Kat's friend and co-director Peter Wintonik, made by his daughter Mira, and High Rise, the multi-award-winning interactive documentary series Kat made for the National Film Board of Canada. Kat, welcome to Blockhouse Conversations.
Hi, Carol. It's great to hear you.
I'm delighted to have you here with us today. I kind of know how the pandemic's going for you because you've been so great at documenting it.
It's a wacky year for all of us. And for our family, I have an elder in my life and a very little person in my life that we've been really working hard to protect. And my father is in long-term care here in Canada. Canada is one of the has one of the worst rates of COVID and death in long-term care facilities. And my father had moved in 2 weeks before the lockdown.
Oh, I did and not so, realize that was amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's been this whirlwind experience of trying to just get a grasp on some of the issues that obviously were there long before the pandemic in terms of neglect and gross negligence in my opinion, in terms of how these homes are run here in Canada. But so that's been a real struggle for us. And my daughter is 7. She's turning 8, almost 8. She's 7/11/12 is how she puts it.
Yes. So, yes. Yeah. We're the ager. We talk about 12ths. Absolute. Well, and we'll flag it up for listeners in the notes for this, but you made a wonderful lockdown short film that shows the reality that you're living in with your father and your daughter. And it's a really beautiful film that we already featured on Blockhouse Kids. We'll make sure we'll put the link in so people can watch it.
Thanks, Carol. Yeah, it's through the voice of my daughter.
And yes,
it was interesting to interview my daughter formally for the first time.
Oh, and her voice.
Hear about the world through her eyes, her voice and her eyes. Yeah.
Well, and it's great. Looking back, you'll be glad that you got that 7-year-old's perspective. Like everything for documentary makers, it's great to have that as a little time capsule. So I wanted to turn to the two films that you've picked for us to look at today. The first, the one that you've chosen, is Wintopia, and this is a film that it's not the one that you've made directly, but you have in fact had a role in it because it's made about a friend and collaborator of yours, Peter Wintonik, by his daughter. Can you sort of set it up for listeners what the film's about and your role in it?
Yeah, absolutely. Peter Wintonik was a friend and also a collaborator. And he died 7 years ago, almost to the day. And he was an important part of my life and my working life. I was honored to actually be present during his passing. And this is a film that is composed of archives that he shot, maybe 15 years worth of, I think, 300 tapes of a film that he always wanted to make. But there's so many more layerings to it. It was put together by his daughter, Mira Burt Wintonik, pretty much 5 or 6 years following Peter's death. It took her a long time to make it. And it's a film that not only have I seen many times during the making of it, I watched it again last night, the final cut, but it's a film that was shot adjacent to my life over the last 30 years.
I knew Peter a little bit, a lot less than you, but enough to have had a couple breakfasts with him at film festivals over the years and things like that. And I think that it works for those that knew him, but it also is such a wonderful portrait of a man and of a creative. It's about parenting. It's about father. It's about being a father because in fact, she's very honest about the fact that he would spend months at a time traveling the world. So it's about her relationship with him It's also about the creative process. It's about utopia. It's about documentary making and the wonder of filmmaking. So I was so pleased when it came out. And as you said, it took a few years to make, to see how multi-layered and wondrous a film that this became. So I have an excerpt that I think would be good to, for people to at least listen to. It's towards the end of the film, and I'm just going to run it now so that we could hear it.
Here, what are you making a picture of? You going to bring it?
No.
Want to show it to me? Hold it up so I can look at it. What is it about?
I'm not sure. It's just a picture.
Well, what inspires me? Well, it's the vermilion ochre paint which slashes through Van Gogh's sunflowers. It's this magic 8mm camera that my father gave me when I was 7 years old. It's the song and dance of the northern lights in the Yukon sky. It's the resonating screens. It's the visual poets and the hopeless revolutionaries. It's kind gestures and its grace. It's an Oscar Peterson piano riff just zipping down the street. It's the lives of every unknown artist and every woman artist whom conventional history has forgotten. It's my friends and family and my partner, Christine, and my daughter, Mira. These are the saints of an unnamed goddess, which I call the art of life or the life of art. This is what inspires me. Once the power of people is unleashed and a better world is realized, we no longer have to call it utopia. It will simply be the way it is. But now, it's up to you.
It must have been such a difficult process for Mira to go through, because in essence, she was understanding by going through these 300 tapes that that she found after he died. She was understanding what took him away from her for months on end, year after year after year, and this is what he was up to. And in some cases, it's actually not very much, right? He's by himself with a camera, exploring different corners of the world, and musing and indulging his creative creative need to explore and to work on a lot of levels as a creative, at the same time that her life was unfolding back home and she was growing up. And I did admire how she didn't shy away from the fact that she felt that, that he often chose to travel over her.
People see so many different things. And I, as Peter's friend, watching the final film, but also watching Mira's, several cuts that she was gracious enough to share with me along the way, I was really struck by this confrontation, in a way, of Mira's approach to the editing and the narration, and even looking at herself through the lens of her father's camera. This feeling that Peter didn't see her for who she was. And that, he was, she had to watch all this footage, like you said, him being everywhere else but with her. And that is just such a difficult thing to see.
Yes.
In your friend. But you also see it in yourself, having become a mother, a parent in these last 7 years, pretty much after Peter died, I became a parent within months. And so that was also a very interesting process for me in terms of understanding the relationship between creativity and being there for somebody else and seeing people for who they are. And with your friends, you often spend your time thinking, you find the similarities. And with family, not to make it dichotomous, but with family, it's sometimes about that confrontation of you're so not like me, which you really see play out in this film in profound ways. Peter loved the camera. He was a performer. He trained as an actor. And so life was a performance for him, and performance was life, and not so for Mira. Yeah. And so he kept turning the camera on her and on the world in ways that really were unsettling and uncomfortable for her. And he didn't always see that or respect that. And that's a really, that's a big tension in the film. And I often wonder, you know, what would he think looking at the film?
Yes.
I think it would be very hard for him to watch this film. And good ways, in good way, in the way that he always wanted the world to challenge him. So yeah, that's perhaps the unfinished business as the film comes to a close and there's a resolution in a way, or a new stage of moving on with Peter's death. There's this feeling of what would he think seeing this film?
Well, and as you say, I'm sure that he would embrace it and find it bittersweet or painful to have to see it through her eyes so directly. Your film that you made with Peter, Seeing is Believing, is makes an appearance in the film, and it was actually quite an extraordinary scene that they show, and I wanted to mention it. It's this and this film was about early days of camcorder and the use of camcorder for grassroots organization and advocacy around the world. And this scene that they show, Mira shows a clip of in the film, is shows a camcorder coming to Philippines, right? You could explain better than me, but it's quite an extraordinary moment, the way that they treat this camcorder.
It is an incredible moment. We were following, tracing the delivery of a handycam from Witness, a human rights organization in New York City, through Joey, Joey Lozano, who was a human rights activist and journalist in the Philippines. And he brought the camera in turn to a coalition of indigenous tribes on the island of Mindanao in southern Philippines. And the scene you're talking about is when they formally receive the camera in a traditional indigenous ritual, which involves all the hands of the chiefs holding the camera together and placing it on a table and performing all sorts of rites on it, including, not showed in the film in Wintopia, but they do sacrifice a chicken and then with a feather put the blood of the chicken on the camera. So it really exemplifies the power, the spiritual power with which the tribes embody this powerful piece of technology. And it was really an amazing scene because the camera turns on in the hands of the chief and he starts filming. And of course he captures a shot of Peter Wintonic. He was doing the sound, I was doing camera and he was doing sound. And it's one of my favorite moving images of Peter because he's looking back at that camera in the hands of this chief. But it's a striking moment for me in terms of all the cinema and all the conversations that we've had with Peter. That's probably one of my favorites.
Well, and it's, I don't know at what point you became so interested in technology and the use of it in filmmaking, but this film is certainly the first time I became aware of you and Peter was seeing this film that came out 2002, was it? Or
it's
really wonderful, sort of again a snapshot of a moment in time and what this emerging technology of the camcorder was meaning for these people around the world. And you've really made this focus of your career ever since, is the intersection of filmmaking and technology. That I think is really come to the fore with your second project that you picked today, which is High Rise, which is this landmark multi-award winning project that you made with the National Film Board of Canada. Can you set up the project for us? It's can't be summed up in a few words.
High Rise was an experiment in documentary making across many platforms, not just in terms of form. We certainly were invited by the Film Board to experiment with many different types of technologies, but we were also encouraged to explore and experiment with content and the process of making films or making documentaries. So it was very co-created, it was community-based. We worked very closely with academics, co-created, you know, with technologies as well, with technological systems. And so it was a film that spanned 7 years. It was very local here in Toronto. We worked very closely with a community of residents in two high-rise buildings in northwestern Toronto, in a community called Etobicoke. Toronto has some of that, has many, many high rises, perhaps one of the highest rates in North America. Although you wouldn't think it in terms of these mid-century high rises, we have over 1,000 of them, all in the inner suburbs of Toronto. So it's a really interesting urban pattern. But it was also very global. So we took this project, this notion of density, of urban density, and looked at it through the lens of high-rise buildings around the world. And we used the high-rise building almost as a storytelling prism, as an opportunity to tell stories about so many other things. And importantly, I think the central thesis of the work was to equate being a citizen of the city with being a citizen of the web. So equating density with digital. And I think, you know, looking back at some of that material now during the pandemic has been really interesting to see how prescient some of the things that not that we were saying, but that the residents in the high-rise buildings were saying, you know, very transnational folks that had traveled the world, often fleeing really terrible conditions elsewhere, finding themselves in high-rise buildings here in Toronto. As new Canadians, really telling us about what the future would hold for the world in terms of both the perils and the possibilities of these technologies.
Well, and it's so interesting when you delve into the website, and this is a multi-project, multi-year endeavor, and where you keep introducing different elements to it, and there's a lot of interactivity in terms of being able to dig deeper in for more information, 360 degree filming, and just different ways of telling the story. And I just hope people will dive into it as a result of this more. But I just was wondering, how did you go about tackling the scale of this project? And what was the most sort of rewarding part of it for you? And I'm really interested in, because it's clear that the co-collaboration is an element throughout all the work that you do and the work that you're doing at the moment. So if you could sort of define how that works in practice, that would be great.
High-rise was really pure documentary process in a lot of ways, because it was given a lot of time. I mean, time is the best friend of a documentarian. And we had that. And I'm so profoundly appreciative of the National Film Board that we were given that. And so we were able to go step by step and really build each, you know, it, when you look at high rise now, it seems like this mass thing, a mass collection of many, many, perhaps, you know, high rise buildings all over the place. But really, it was built from the ground up. And each project often started with a very small seed, perhaps one small conversation that we'd had with one resident in a high-rise building. I mean, what was happening in the process of making high-rise was I was having a lot of conversations with people on the ground about the conditions of the high-rise building. So whether that's residents or architects, urban planners, activists, housing activists, all that, you know, what do the cities of the future or now look like that we haven't really caught up to understanding? And on the other side, I was having a lot of conversations with technologists and learning about the amazing developments that were happening at the time, particularly in terms of open source technologies and 3D capacity. So WebGL was just coming out at the time that we were beginning conversations around 1 millionth tower, for example, where we were talking about putting together architects with the residents to reimagine the landscape around a very specific high rise here in Toronto. It was a very small story, you know, how to reimagine a neglected tennis court. But when we started putting these two ideas together and imagining this landscape in a 3D browser, you know, a 3D space directly in the browser, which was a really new emergent technology, suddenly it became of interest to audiences around the world. So when we launched the project, One Millionth Tower, on Wired, the front page of Wired.com, we had visits from, I don't know, like 162 countries within 48 hours. And it was phenomenal to me how these really local small stories could become universally resonant when you attach them to that network of the web. And that in fact, you know, the things that make us feel extremely segregated are the things that we can actually see as global patterns.
Well, and one of the things that emerged from it, but I don't think was part of it initially, was this New York Times collaboration. Is that right? And that is, again, I just immersed myself in the entire in its entirety, and it was wonderful experience. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I believe that they opened up a lot of their archive images to you to delve into, as well as generated from users donations of their own.
Yeah, New York Times approached us after we had launched the first documentary in Hi-Rise, which was called Out My Window. And so that project did quite well. And the New York Times, which was in a new department called the OpDocs section of the New York Times, approached us and said, you know, high-rise buildings, New York City, maybe there's a match here. And we said, of course. And they were so, again, they had that really open view, which I think is so necessary in this experimental stage we're in with documentary. And they said, what are you interested in? And I had said, I was always really interested in the history of the high-rise building. And they said, well, that's fascinating, because we have this archive of undigitized photographs at the New York Times, 6 to 8 million photographs that have not been put into the digital collection. It's this, you know, this treasure we have. We have one archivist who lives and works down there. Why don't you come and see what you can find? And it was really like I had won the lottery.
Amazing.
I mean, this was phenomenal for me. And so I went to New York Times in New York City for a week, and I spent 5 days down in the basement, third floor, you know, three floors down in this old, you know, rat infested, flooded, you know, seriously, like there was water on the floor. It was just so in such disarray. With Jeff Roth, the amazing archivist, the sole archivist standing. There used to be 26 people running that archive, but it was him alone. And he pulled out photographs for me, I think, and I chose 500 of them, took pictures of them on my iPhone, brought them home, and then weaved together what became Short History of High-Rise, which is a collection of four short films that are also interactive. So you can watch them just as films, or you can also go into this this interface that Jackie Mint, one of the star creative developers, creative technologists at the New York Times, helped build, where you can go down and learn more about the photographs, play some games, and really try and touch the photographs in the way that I was lucky enough to touch. That was the concept of the piece. So it was truly a highlight for me in the high-rise during my high-rise years.
Well, it was a wonderful experience. And as you say, the part of that concept is being able to touch it like you were, is you can see the front and the back of these photos, and you can flip them over and see them. And I just love that. So yes, I thought it was wonderful. It's well deserving. It was this project that won the Peabody Award, right?
That was, yes, the Peabody, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. And you've also won an Emmy for High-Rise. What was that like?
There were two Emmys. Yeah, there was one for Short History, and then the first Emmy was for Out My Window.
And so what kind of doors did all of this attention and awards open for you for your next steps?
Well, for me, what was so interesting about that long-term process, those 7 years, is that it opened up partnerships. You know, that was really like not having a goal or a set agenda for High-Rise, but rather the sense of discovery and exploration and real desire to work with people is, I think, the best thing that happened out of that. We were towards the end of High-Rise, we were approached by a new lab at MIT called the Open Documentary Lab. William Euricchio and Sarah Wallazin are the founders of the lab, and they brought us in. And they invited me to be a visiting artist for the last piece of High Rise called Universe Within. And so I was able to develop and produce that work as an artist at MIT. And I just never left, you know. they said, you know, when that came to a close, William asked me, well, what do you want to do next? And I said, well, I'm really interested in developing a co-creation studio. I felt like the work that I had done first with High Rise 7 years, well, secondly with High Rise 7 years, and earlier a project called Filmmaker in Residence, which was 5 years of my life. I felt like I had the privilege of co-creating for so many years. And along the way, I met so many people that also work in this way, in documentary, but other forms of media and in other sectors. In, you know, Filmmaker in Residence was at a hospital. So I met a lot of people working in the health field, working in that way, in design, in urban planning, in so many different fields. And yet I also encountered the frustration that people felt where co-creative methodologies are not always honored or recognized. There's no scholarship around them. And I said, I'd really love to spend a bit of time building up foundations for that. And William and Sarah said, we'll come here and start that at MIT. And so for the last 5 years, I've been the artistic director of the co-creation studio at MIT Open Documentary Lab. I continue to live in Toronto, but work with people at MIT and internationally. I mean, we did a big field study called Collective Wisdom, where we interviewed 166 people about co-creative methodologies. We would try to sort of document them and provide case studies and create a taxonomy around it. But we also run workshops. We've just had an Indigenous digital delegation visit MIT. Unfortunately, it was virtual. We were hoping to do it in person, but the virtual version turned out really well. We had 10 Indigenous media scholars and artists based in Canada meet with over 60 MIT scholars and researchers talking about Indigenous epistemologies, artificial intelligence, and digital worlds. So it was a real exchange of knowledge both ways. It was not just about, technological innovation or domain knowledge in that respect, but it was also about challenging some of the worldviews that drive the technological innovation and introducing Indigenous epistemology in that world. So it was truly a remarkable event. There's an incredible keynote by Dr. Duke Redbird that's available online that I think is one of the most powerful lectures I've ever seen at Open Documentary Lab. So really, really honored to be doing this kind of work partnered with the Indigenous Screen Office.
Oh, it sounds amazing work. And I know that you're doing a lot of, you give a lot of talks about documentary and about collaborative and interactive documentary. I was wondering, what are the main points that you make in these talks?
Breaking open process. You know, I think that it's just so much more valuable. And this is really going back to Peter Wintonic, and everything we see unfold in Wintopia is trying to, move away from the formulaic parts of making media and writing and shooting and filming and all these things that sort of make it more efficient are the things that make it less meaningful. And so how can we learn? And this is about every process, not just documentary making. It's about the way we do science. And perhaps one of the things that the pandemic has taught us is to break down some of the protocols and methodologies that don't work for us. You know, speaking of epistemologies, you know, like the competitive nature of scientific research has really stopped us from being able to move quickly. And that's what scientists have learned with, for example, the vaccine research is like, this is the most collaborative global effort we've ever seen. And look at how quickly it happened. And the same can be said for documentary. When you take away some of those, that scaffolding or that factory-like process and start wandering a little bit more, you know, and being a little bit more experimental and humble and just listen and be present, you know, be here now, as Peter Wintonic would say. Those are the things that will hopefully make work that is both meaningful, beautiful, confronting, but also moves us into a future that we want to see, want to live in.
Well, I think actually that sums it up so nicely that I'm going to leave it there. But Kat, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my honor and pleasure.
Thanks for listening. I'm pleased to say that Bertha Dockhaus will be hosting a special screening of Wintopia on the 28th of January, followed by a Q&A with director Mira Burt Wintonic. Please subscribe to our newsletter or check out the website for more details. I hope you have enjoyed this second mini-season of Dockhaus Conversations. If you have, please do spread the word and leave us a review. Thanks as always to my colleague Sean for all his tech wizardry. See you soon.